Good morning. I'm Rusty. I'm pastor here. And if you're new, we're glad you're here. If you're not new, we're kind of tired of you. That's really not true. Why did I say that? It's none of that's in this. I'm old. So anyway, I am glad you're here. And if you're on campus or online, if you're online, we have resources you can get. You can go to our website or download our app. Those of you that are on campus, we have this take-home sheet. It's got the message notes, and then on the back of it is a way to apply it. So I hope you'll get that when you leave outside of either one of these doors. We're in this series going through stories Jesus told, parables. And a parable is just it's a fictional story that illustrates something that is extremely important and true. Before I get into it, I want to tell you something that happened to me and Becky years ago. We got married and moved to Fort Worth, Texas for me to go to grad school. And we were there about 8 years, and we found there's a great church we were part of. It was a brand new church. It had just started, and we loved being a part of it. Oddly enough, I was the backup worship director, which meant that if the worship leader got ill, I got the call. They were really hurting in the music and worship department, but anyway, so one Sunday I got the call, and I'm driving to go out and figure out what in the world am I going to do. And if you've ever been to Fort Worth, Texas, there's an intersection. You have Interstate 35, north and south, and you have Interstate 30, east and west. We were going north on Interstate 35, 55, 60, whatever the speed limit, plus 5, going up. And all of a sudden, I see a car coming toward me in one of the three lanes that are only for people going north. This one's going south. Have no idea how it got there. It was not a good look. I slammed my brakes on and slid into a couple lanes, trying to figure out what in the world is going on. I get out of the car, and you never should do this on an interstate or freeway, but something bad was about to happen. I get out, and I start flagging this car down. There's this elderly lady with 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock position like this. I don't know how she got on there. It didn't make any sense. I'm flagging her down, trying to get her to stop. She is oblivious to me, still going 10, 15 miles an hour, whatever she was doing. And I'm trying, because I know we're getting ready to have a major accident. Plus, I didn't want to be standing on the freeway. And then she does this. She turns and got on an exit, which is really good, heading toward Dallas. Had no idea what she was doing, why she was there. She's just moseying back to Dallas going 10, 15 miles an hour, clueless to the danger she was putting everybody else in. She was lost. Happens a lot. I have a good friend that Becky and I knew that was going to Williamsburg one day on 64. He exits, and there was a car coming up the exit, lost like that lady was, head-on collision, he was killed. Sometimes lostness is really, really dangerous. And we're going to be looking about this idea of lost. Lost was Jesus' favorite term for people that were not yet believers. Sometimes you'll hear people say, oh, those pagans or those heathen, or you come up with all kind of names you want. Jesus' favorite term was just saying they were lost. And it carries a lot of meaning to it. And these three stories that we're going to be looking at today will explain it in a way I hope makes sense to all of us. Because it's absolutely crucial as his church that we get this. If we miss it, it will cause a lot of harm. So I'm going to start. This is in Luke chapter 15. It says, tax collectors and other notorious sinners often came to listen to Jesus teach. This made the Pharisees and teachers of religious law complain that he was associating with such sinful people, even eating with them. So Jesus tells this story. Now, here's the scene. Jesus was regularly attracting bigger and bigger crowds, and they were made up of all kinds of people. For some, they were just attracted to this guy that seemed to be kind and generous. He was gracious. He was a rabbi, so it meant he was a well-trained Jewish man, but there was something different about him in the way he talked, the way he carried himself, his interest in other people. When he taught, it was understandable, and it was relatable, and it was compelling. And he wasn't on an ego trip. He wasn't trying to get attention for him. He was trying to He wasn't trying to impress people about himself. He was trying to inspire them to understand their creator, God. He didn't spend time bashing other people. He was positive. He spoke the truth, but he did it in a gracious and kind way. Some of that crowd were, like it said here, notorious sinners. They didn't give a rip about religion, but they were interested in him. Some of them had religious background, but this was very, very different. And then you had another crowd there that were the religious elite, and they absolutely hated what he was doing. They were jealous of his popularity and disgusted with his liberal tendencies. That he would hang out with these notorious sinners, and he would even have meals. He would go to McDonald's with them. They couldn't believe it. At that point, this Pharisee group, they were a holy huddle, and they kept away from anybody that wasn't like them. And they were extremely disparaging and spoke ill of anybody that didn't believe. They looked down on everybody else. So what we have here is a scene where the unrighteous were intrigued with Jesus and the self-righteous were irritated at him. That's a tough crowd. What do you do? The unrighteous were interested in him. They may not have been the least bit interested in the religious part, but they were really wanting to find out more about him. And some of them probably had this idea, why would God care about me? I've been around religious people, and I know they don't care about me. In fact, they label me a notorious sinner. And the self-righteous fueled the hopelessness other people felt because they looked down on him, and they withdrew in a way that made them feel like even more like losers. So, Jesus understood his audience really well, and he tells these three stories. Every one of them could relate to the stories, especially the first two. The third one really got people riled up. And what's intriguing about this, and you're going to pick this up, is he cared about both groups. He was genuinely interested in the name brand notorious sinners, but also the religious, pompous elite. So he tells these stories. Looking at him, he goes, if a man had 100 sheep and one of them gets lost, what would he do? Won't he leave the 99 others in the wilderness and go search for the one that's lost until he finds it? The answer is, well, of course. And when he has found that, he will joyfully carry it home on his shoulders. When he arrives, he will call together his friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me because I have found my lost sheep. And he goes on to say, in the same way, here's the point of my story, in the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. Every one of them that heard the story would get it. This was sheep country. They were used to seeing flocks of sheep all around. And for someone to have 100 sheep, it was probably, there were probably multiple owners that had pooled their resources to watch over the sheep. And you and I would probably think, well, that, you know, one sheep gone, that's a 1% loss. That's within the margin of error. That's not how they looked at it at all. They would never have just said, well, that's just one sheep. They would make sure the 99 are cared for. The head shepherd then would go and hunt because... And let me just say this. If anyone ever says, boy, you're just as smart as a sheep, that is not a compliment. Sheep are notoriously, they're not in the Mensa category of animals. They're extremely nearsighted, so they can't see very far ahead. Sheep will overgraze. That's why the shepherd has to keep moving them, because they'll overgraze. They'll graze the grass down to the dirt, to the roots, and kill it. They're not good swimmers. If you swim as good as a sheep, pick another sport. Because if a sheep got into the water, if it get into running water and the wool would suck up all the water, sheep goes in and they can't swim, so they're gone. And they're also prey for all kind of predators. What it said here, this sheep wandered off. It got lost. And the sheep's not smart enough to know it's lost. It was kind of like that lady on I-35. Just kind of wandering around, grazing around, has no idea that it could fall and hurt itself, fall into water, or become a lamb burger. And so what happens is the shepherd goes after the sheep because the shepherd understands the danger, and the shepherd is going to do whatever it takes to get that sheep back. And when he gets it back, they celebrate because there's one that was found, one that wasn't lost. And then Jesus says this. So you understand this story, and he goes, in the same way, there is more joy in heaven over one lost sinner who repents and returns to God than over 99 others who are righteous and haven't strayed away. Saying God really cares about the lost being found, regardless of how they got lost. He goes on, tells a second story. He goes, or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Won't she light a lamp and sweep the entire house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she will call on her friends and neighbors and say, rejoice with me because I have found my lost coin. In the same way, there is joy in the presence of God's angels when even one sinner repents. Now, you might think 10 coins is not a big deal, but that particular coin is worth a little over a day's wage. The 10 coins she had were probably all of her savings. They didn't have Social Security. They didn't have Medicare, Medicaid, and all this kind of stuff. And in many cases, you were on your own. And so that wasn't 1%. That was 10% of what she owned. And in the loss of it, she couldn't say, well, it's just 10%. No, I got to do something. And in houses there, they didn't have Anderson windows then. So a house was built, and it had one opening that let a little bit of light in. If they needed more light, they had to light candles and all because they just didn't have they didn't have skylights and stuff you and I are used to. So she'd light a candle, she would go, and the floors were all dirt. And you can imagine, you drop one of those coins and pretty quickly it can just get under a layer of dirt. So she hunted for it. And when she found it, 10% of her savings has been rescued. And she can't wait to tell everybody about what happened. And Jesus said, you all understand that circumstance. Listen to this. He goes, in the same way, there is joy in the presence of God's angels when even one sinner repents. One lost person turns and follows God, and there is a party in heaven. When we do baptisms here, people get come out of the water, and they hear people applauding. And it's just a sense of what's happening in heaven when God sees someone cross the line and decide to follow him. There is a party. And everybody that heard those stories would have said, oh, wow, I get that. That makes sense. And then he tells this third story. Doesn't make any sense. It gets them riled up. They're thinking, that there's something wrong with what he's saying here. This doesn't make sense. You know, we sang that song a minute ago, The Reckless Love of God. We've had people get really angry that we sing that song. How dare you say God is reckless? We're not saying that God is reckless. What we're saying is his love seems that way because it doesn't make sense. It's not giving someone what they're due. It's giving so much more. Jesus tells this story. He goes, to illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. He said, a man had two sons. The younger son told his father, I want my share of your estate now before you die. So his father agreed to divide the wealth between his sons. Can you imagine that scene? You got a younger son that's been there for a while. You got an older son. The younger son has been a pain. He doesn't like the restrictions, doesn't like the guidelines. He wants to do what he wants to do when he wants to do it. And he's decided, you know what? I could do a lot better off on my own, so I want my part of the estate. Now, legally, the way it was set up there, if he had two heirs like this, the older we get 2/3 of the estate, the younger we get 1/3. There was no requirement that happened before the owner of the estate passed away, but sometimes, and this is an aside, I think the way we do inheritance is kind of goofy. I think inheritance ought to be incremental while someone's still alive to help people understand how to use the resources. There's some people that inherit all kind of resources. They don't have any idea how to handle it. And there's no one around to help them with it. It's kind of like when people win the lottery and they go broke, which many of them do, because if you can't handle a tiny bit of money, how are you going to handle millions? Anyway, that's free. And we'll have a financial seminar one day and someone else will teach it. But anyway, so here's the deal. The younger son said, I want my part now. And utterly to the surprise of Jesus' audience, he says, the father agreed. He liquidated the part of his estate he needed to give that son one third of what would have been his inheritance. He accommodates the son. Sounds stupid, doesn't it? But the father does. He knew the son was miserable being there, knew he didn't like it, knew he wanted to be on his own, and he wasn't going to be able to change the son's attitude by forcing him there. It's embarrassing to the father and costly to him because he got to liquidate enough of his estate to give him one third. Goes on to say, a few days later, this younger son packed all of his belongings and moved to a distant land, and there he wasted all his money in wild living. When I was in high school, in college, we used to talk about this. We would start on Monday morning talking about the next weekend, talking about how we're going to get wasted. We thought that, there's nothing better than getting wasted. In fact, why don't we start Tuesday? You know, just it wasted just me. I'm going to throw off all restraint, do whatever I feel like doing. And that's what this son did. It says, about the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his field to feed the pigs. The young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. So the son is finally free. No restraint. He can do whatever he wants to. And he does. Has none of the limitations or moral code that his father had. And now he's spent it all. He didn't keep any rainy day cushion. He had nothing. His friends are gone. He's hungry. He's hurting. And when it says he hired himself out to work for a guy that had a pig farm, to any of the Jews listening to this, that would be like the lowest of the low things you could ever do. Pigs were considered unclean. And to work with pigs would have, there's nothing worse you could do. And the fact that he was jealous over what the pigs were eating just shows how far gone he was. At this point, it's just a picture of him coming to the stark realization that he's alone and helpless and hopeless. And then it says this, when he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, at home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare. And here I am, dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant. The picture is that this guy really was humbled. Some people are humiliated but never humbled. They're humiliated by their circumstances, but they immediately begin blaming somebody else for why it happened. Well, Dad didn't give me enough. He didn't train me well enough. The current administration has not provided a social network for the rest. It's always someone else's fault. But he came to a point of realizing that it was his fingerprints over all of his circumstances, and he owned it. Until you and I get to a point of humbly acknowledging our own guilt and fault, we'll never really get anywhere. We'll continually play the victim game. He was humbled. He was broken. And now he saw what he so arrogantly despised was really good. His father was a good man. The limitations were there because they were important. There were guardrails to live within. And he found out why they're there. So he takes some action. He decides to take this humiliating risk of going home and hoping that maybe his dad, while he would never be a son again, his dad might take him on as a hired servant. So he returned home to his father. And while he was still yet a long way off, his father saw him coming. Filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son, embraced him, kissed him. This is, the audience hearing this would have said, that's absolutely absurd. No dignified man would ever, they hadn't invented jogging yet. No dignified person would go running. And they definitely wouldn't go after someone that smelled like pigs and someone that had treated him so disgustingly before. They would have had servants out there to keep him from coming anywhere near the property. That's not what this father did. His son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against both heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy of being called your son." And you know, he's ready to say, "Would you please take me on as a hired servant?" But the father cuts him off and doesn't let him say that. But his father said to the servants, "Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandal for his feet, and kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and is now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found." So the party began. I've heard a lot of people say that someone's dead to them because that's the way they want it to be. There'll be no restoration. Not the way you treated me. His father was nothing like that. You get the idea that this father had been praying and watching and waiting and hoping. And it said that while his son was still a long way off, the father saw him. And he didn't wait for the son to grovel. He didn't wait for the son to come here and to try to prove that the son had really changed. He could tell. He could see it. The son had always been on his heart. So they have a party. The robe and the ring and the sandals just symbolize that he wasn't a servant. He wasn't just a hireling. Now he was restored to being a real son. He was part of the family in a way that he had never really been before. Goes on to say, "Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working. When he returned home, he heard the music and dancing in the house, and he asked one of the servants, 'What's going on?' 'Your brother is back,' he was told, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf. We are celebrating because of his safe return.'" The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him. See the father again? He knows the older son is irritated and furious, probably thinking his dad is weak, doesn't have a spine. And the father goes to the older son with a similar attitude that he did the younger one. He comes out gently. His father came out and begged him. And the older son replied, "All these years I've slaved for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to do. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back," it's not my brother, this son of yours. You see the distance? "He comes back after squandering your money." It wasn't the father's money anymore. He had given it to the son. And he says, "Squandering your money on prostitutes." That was never mentioned earlier. You know what happens when we get bitter and judgmental of other people? We can add to their offenses. It plays in our mind. We keep getting more and more offense against them, and we add to it whenever we want to because we feel justified because we're self-righteous. He's so irritated. His father said to him, "Look, dear son, I know what I would have said to him after the back of my hand went across his face a few times. I'm not God. His father said to him, "Look, dear son, you have always stayed by me, and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate this happy day, for your brother was dead and has come back to life. He was lost, but now he is found." The older brother has been part of the family. He looks the part. But he says this to them, "I have slaved for you." What does that say? Jesus is drawing a picture here. There's some people that are very, very righteous. They go through the rules and the rituals, and they're doing it because somehow they're earning something An older brother felt like he deserved a lot more, even though 2/3 of the estate was his. He wanted all of it. The self-righteous and the unrighteous have this in common. Both are lost. Both need to be rescued. Isaiah 53:6, all of us like sheep have strayed away. We have left God's path to follow our own. And our own might be irreligious, it might be very religious. It might be immoral, or it might be very moral. But it's still me in charge. I'm doing it for my own benefit. The younger son deliberately rejected his father and his values. He didn't pretend anything about it. But the older son had too. Outwardly, he went through the motions, but his heart was far from where it should be. He had this religious pride in him that closed him off and made him hard and cold. They were both lost, just like all of us are. And apart from God doing something for us, we will stay that way. Jesus didn't come, like many make it look like, to shame and reject. He came to seek and to rescue. Regardless of where we are, religious, irreligious, moral, immoral, it doesn't matter. We're apart from a faith in Jesus Christ, we are lost. And Jesus made it very clear why he came. He said, "For the Son of Man came to seek and to save those who are lost." And he came to all the different kinds. And I want to tell you, as Jesus' church, we have to grab hold of this. It's easy to talk about it, maybe to give mental assent to it, but it's different to really live it out. We are his search and rescue team. Anything less than that, we are really not where he wants us to be. Instead of the common stereotype, and many people that are not part of churches will say this is the standard, is they know what the church is against and who they're against. They don't really know much about what the church is for. Being judgmental and critical has become very, very popular. But we ought to be known for good news. We ought to be known for reaching out to those that don't get it yet. Not because we have it all together, but because we've been rescued, now we have something to offer others. We need to let people know that God is searching for them. There are a lot of things in our world that are wrong and screwed up. We could spend all of our time pointing fingers at all the wrong and all the wrongdoers and all that. Can you imagine if God did that? If that's all he focused on, was when you and I are wrong and we screwed up and we blew it, we would have no hope at all. He is so much like this father that put up with so much because he cared so much. If our primary focus is what we're against, we are just like the older brother. We need to carefully hold on to grace and truth. Not one or the other, but both of them. And we need to communicate the truth in a way that is loving and caring and compassionate. Another thing you see in these stories is God doesn't just show patience for the lost, he pursues them. Yet he doesn't force things. The thing about that father with the younger son, some would say, well, why'd the father give him the money? Why didn't he just lock him in his room? Handcuff him to a wall. What good would that have done? It wouldn't have changed his heart. The father let the son go. He was going to reap what he sowed. And as painful as it was, his prayer was that somehow the son would see the emptiness of his decisions. The older son stayed home, but that sure wasn't a cure for him, was it? He was equally rebellious, just in a different way. He was self-righteous and full of pride. And it's amazing to me how the father loved both of them. Jesus does the same. to the audience he was speaking to that day and what he offers you and me. He loves notorious sinners, and you guys can come up with your own list of those, and they're all going to be different, and some of you are sitting next to some. We always like to come up with our categories of, wow, at least I'm not one of those. When we do that, we're just being Pharisees. Every one of us need what only Jesus offers. And he'll take us as we are, but he doesn't want us to stay that way. This lostness thing is a big deal. And whether I'm deliberately lost or accidentally lost, I still need to be found. And that's what these three stories tell us, that God is in the searching business. And those of us that follow him are on his search and rescue team. My attitude toward those who don't know Christ shows whether I truly follow Jesus or not. I'm the only one that knows what goes on in my thought bubble. When I see those people, when I think about certain ones that I don't think are worth it, and God is saying, son, you've got work to do. I wish I could rip out the seats here in the carpeting, because on the cement floor throughout this room, it's full of names and prayers for people that we were hoping when we built this facility, people would come to know Jesus. Long before this room had a roof on it, it was just a concrete slab. We had the people that were part of New Hope then come and write names. Some of your names are on this floor. We exist so we can help others get found, because we've been found, we've been loved, and we have something to offer. No, we have someone to offer. Not because we're so good, heaven forbid that we would ever say that, but because he is, and what he offers can't be found anywhere else. This is who we are. This is what we need to be about. Let's pray together. God, you know us inside and out. You know there are ways that we're like the notorious sinners, but you also know that some of us are Pharisees through and through. It's so easy for us to compare with others and to make ourselves look better when the only comparison we should have is with your son. And to realize that we've been saved and rescued because of his love and his kindness, not because of our deserving it. And our being part of your family means that we are to mirror your heart for the lost too. Help us to see others the way you do, like the father in this story. May a red light go off on our spiritual dashboard when we start getting judgmental or we start writing people or groups of people off. Help us to learn to handle the truth with grace and love. Unsettle us in areas where we are not like you. And remind us that because of you, we have hope and a future. We ask all this in Christ's name. Amen.